This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. It is the 8th of February, 2018, and the morning run begins. It's Deep Ascent. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. Remember, you can always be part of the conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 and or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Brian, brilliant Thursday morning. Are you excited? The weekend is upon us.
Yeah, the weekend is close by. Lots of news happening, though, around the world.
Absolutely. We can begin with the news that just come in. Angela Merkel makes finally has her coalition after 4 months. It was kind of a difficult 4 months because Germany hadn't seen perhaps this long a period of uncertainty around its government. Her conservative Christian Democrat Union has finally formed a government, or at least has an agreement to form a government, the centre-left Social Democrats.
I think Germany is the leader of Europe, with this with this settlement of the leadership issue, I think that's going to be a very important positive news for the Eurozone as a whole, because that uncertainty has impacted it tremendously.
Yeah, okay. Now, also coming out of China leading in so many ways around the world in terms of, you know, questions of environmental protection and such. But there's also the darker side. The darker side comes with shades. Apparently, police in China have begun using sunglasses equipped with facial recognition technology to identify suspected criminals.
You know, Sharad, it's quite amazing. China apparently has the biggest, world's biggest camera surveillance network. So there's something like 170 million CCTV cameras already in place. Apparently, they're going to install another 400 million. So literally, you're going to have one camera to every three persons in China. Quite amazing the level of surveillance that they're going through.
Yeah, and also, you know, because when we say criminals, everybody's going to sign up on this because they're thinking, you know, of course we want robbers and thieves and former rapists and whatever to be easily identified by police. But what about crimes against the state? What about that whole other category of criminality, which actually has to do with, at least in case of China, a lack of democratic norms? Norms and practices.
Yep. Big Brother has got his tentacles everywhere.
Yeah. Maybe we should use a non-gendered term for Big Brother. Maybe Big Sibling.
Big Sibling.
Okay. Also, turning our attention to the African continent, South Africa's Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa says he's holding direct talks with embattled President Jacob Zuma over transfer of power. Some observers expect that Jacob Zuma might resign in the next couple of days.
Yeah, so, you know, he's facing extensive, and this is Mr. Zuma, he's facing extensive corruption charges. So he's had a lot of pressure to quit since December when Ramaphosa replaced him as the leader of the ANC, or the African National Congress. So, hopefully.
Well, you know, if you remember with Jacob Zuma, there was the question of that mansion that was built with the help of the Gupta brothers. The Gupta brothers are entrepreneurs from India, and they managed to weasel their way into South African society and compromise many politicians. The Gupta brothers are really a story worth telling. You know, how they operate, both in terms of business and also in politics.
Yeah, because they have very, very extensive business interests, not only in South Africa, but throughout the continent.
Next up, we look at micro-influencers and whether they can make a difference. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Brian Fernandez. And the morning run continues. It's just 9 minutes past six in the morning. Now, in Singapore, the government there has decided that it's going to pay some 28 micro-influencers with a combined reach of about 100,000 for a three-month marketing campaign, which started sometime last month. According to this report that we have from Straits Times Singapore, the initiative called hashtag Climate Action Singapore Instagram Photo Contest involves the micro-influencers posting photographs of themselves practicing eco-friendly habits in Singapore and urging others to do the same. Now, for those of you who don't know what a micro-influencer is, it is, according to Forbes, anybody who has a following of between 1,000 and 100,000 on social media, which is not difficult to achieve if you're actually active in any platform, whether it's LinkedIn or Facebook or, you know, Twitter as I'm on, or Instagram.
Yeah, and it's quite savvy of them to try to use micro influencers. So basically, essentially, then what you do is you're getting to different target audiences in a very limited way without spending a lot of money, because a lot of these influencers who have very broad reach, you're not really sure who the audiences are. So they've taken a very targeted approach to try to achieve their marketing objectives, and I think that's quite commendable.
Yeah, so what we understand from the report is that the Ministry of Finance is spending the same amount of money, but they're getting more bang for their buck, or as you put it, Brian, it's a little more targeted. But the ministry in that has engaged them directly is the Ministry of Environment and Water Resources. And so I'm wondering what kind of practices will they be showcasing and whether this will be, you know, good stuff. I mean, is it the kind of, you know, things that can go viral, like saving water? How exactly would you do that? Or flushing only when things kind of go from yellow to mellow, or flush, mellow to,
you know, a lot of toilets have actually those dual flush systems. So if you take a pee, for example, you use the one that, you know, with the shorter flush, and then if you do other stuff, well, you do it.
Yeah, well, you know, some of us are challenged that way and have to use the shorter flush. But I mean, look, is this going to be compelling stuff for social media? I mean, okay, so somebody has gone to the toilet, unless it's an extraordinarily beautifully taken and composed shot of somebody flushing a toilet. I can't see how this is going to be very compelling.
Well, it could be, you know, simple water-saving stuff. So I'm thinking of Ministry of Environment, water-saving stuff, like, for example, taking, you know, somebody just has a 2 or 3 second clip. I took a very short shower for like, you know, two or three minutes instead of my normal 20-minute showers just to refresh myself. Just that the act of maybe tweeting that. Or
well, some of
like
us
that.
Look better in the shower than others. But okay, let's look at some of the examples they're given. They have Marcus Nye, who posed on a bicycle and with the caption, "Global warming is real. We should do our part by reducing carbon footprint. What's more, we can burn some calories while making a difference to fight climate change." Now, Marcus, yeah, so there is Marcus Nye. He's an attractive young man. He's posing. The bicycle's, you look at the picture, Brian, the bicycle's not going anywhere. You know, he's just kind of like posing on a bike.
Now, he got 300,
yeah, he got 355 likes. I suspect that Marcus Nye will get 355 likes regardless of what he does. I mean, he could be eating a box of cornflakes and people would still like it just because he's attractive.
You're being a skeptic in terms of the effectiveness.
Do I sound
of
like
this. In terms of the effectiveness of this campaign. But you see, the thing is, what they're trying to do, and kudos to them, they're trying to reach out and I'm talking about referring to the Ministry of Environment in Singapore. They're trying to reach out in different ways because previously, I think a lot of their marketing campaigns are a lot more passive. This one, it's a lot more active.
Okay, so here you have another example, Taco Mels. She is, a cute, dimpled young lady with, you know, bangs. And she's holding up a remote for the air conditioner. And she says, "I have always been someone of a kind that takes things like our environment for granted. So of late, my mummy has been really into animals, especially those living in the wild." And this actually post goes on for a hell of a long time. But she gets about 172 likes in there.
Yeah, and that's basically about her trying to influence the usage of how you regulate your aircons, for example. So I think studies have shown that actually your optimum temperature for our region, Malaysia, Singapore, whatever, is about 24 degrees Celsius. Most of us have the temperature down to as low as, you know, 18, 19, 20 degrees.
Right. So, but in this instance, again, I think the fact that she has very deep dimples is probably good enough to get her at least 172 likes, regardless of what she does. Now, look, I'm not against the object. I think it's great. I think we all should be fighting climate change. I'm just wondering what this is, I mean, in terms of an effective strategy, normalizing those practices and making people aware and making it part of the conversation. So even if people kind of say, well, okay, am I going to start riding a bike just because Marcus Nye rides a bike and looks like he doesn't sweat even in the hot sun?
But it's a combination of things, and that's why you use a micro-influencer. You see, like the aircon the aircon story, that could make a very tangible difference.
Yeah, but will it be clickbait? Okay, next we talk about Trump and marches, military marches. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Brian Fernandez, and that was James Bay with The Passenger. Now, all of us can be passengers in life, and but some of us want to be more active than others. Would you be an influencer? Would you use your links, Brian, to sell products or push out a message? If somebody paid you to do it?
I think it's something that I haven't really considered until very recently. Possibly. But I'd be very careful about how I did it, though. I wouldn't want, like some of these influencers, it's literally verbal. It's just diarrhea, right? They're constantly pushing stuff because essentially your followers then will be so immune, the message doesn't even register at all.
Well, what about politicians, the kind of messages they try to push out?
Well, one example would be then Donald Trump. Now, he has asked the Pentagon, for example, to organize a large military parade in the nation's capital. And this is according to an article in the Washington Post. Apparently, he made the request to top military officials in January after being impressed with the French Bastille Day parade last year and saying that we're going to have to try and top that. Now, do you like watching military parades, Sharad?
Not particularly, but generally not parades at all, but I must say some of them can be quite spectacular. If you noted, the work of North Korea. North Korea has a festival, where they do these mass displays and stuff, and they're very good because of the level of precision they bring to it. So it is a spectacle, and all spectacles can be quite interesting.
But Sharad, I always associate that with autocratic nations or totalitarian governments. So you mentioned the first example you used was actually North Korea, and I also have images again of I've seen military parades before from Russia and all. They are really spectacular.
But so in this instance, we have a Trump learning from France, which because is reasonably democratic, and Bastille Day, of course, an important part of the French history in terms of its political evolution. So there you don't have an instance of an either autocratic military dictatorship putting on a display. You have a democratic nation putting on display its military hardware.
Yeah, so one of the things, the downsides of this, and when I look at it, so the US is not doing that. They've only had military parades whenever they've had, large wars, and all the veterans coming back. I think with the Gulf Wars, for example, they had military parades after the victory. So, however, one of the key things would be also the cost of staging this every year. This is an era of deficits and trying to balance budgets. These things are quite expensive. The other thing also is the security aspect of, ironically, the security aspect of blocking roads and the inconvenience that it causes. That's quite a significant thing if you want to have that in Washington.
Yeah, the other thing, of course, is that as a military power, as one of the big superpowers, in the last century, they've not won all their wars. And so, if you're only going to celebrate the wars that that you win, you're going to have a big problem. Because what about parades for wars in which you lost, like they lost in the Vietnam War or in their, more precisely, their war against Vietnam? What do they do with that? And what is the psychological net effect of not celebrating a war, especially for those who've made tremendous sacrifices? Because the dead are the dead, but they're still the families of the deceased soldiers. They're also those who lost a limb or their minds, during that conflict. So are you going to say, we're not going to have a parade for you because, we lost that war?
Yeah, I suppose they may have memorial parades, for example, rather than a victory parade. But I find it very interesting that Donald Trump, the person who actually did everything possible to try to avoid military service during the Vietnam War, is actually proposing having military parades.
Donald Trump is going to be stirring up any button he can push in order to legitimize his presidency. Well, we're coming up to the first bulletin of the morning, and taking us there is Stevie Nicks with Talk to Me, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that's Lowell Fulson and Mellow Together. I'm Sherrod Kutin, and mellowing together with me is Brian Fernandez. Talking about work, and because many of us are on the road, many of you are on the road, headed to the office now. Now, what if you didn't have that workplace to go to? You could work remotely and you didn't have to deal with colleagues. This is actually the reality that's upon us in many parts of the world. Help us figure out, whether this hermit approach to work life can succeed. We spoke to Dr. Chua Suk Ning, a clinical psychologist and founder of Relate Malaysia. We asked her if we are gaining or losing by taking out the social factor from work.
I think if you consider that humans have three basic psychological needs, one of which is a social connection, then I think that ultimately taking out the social element from work will be detrimental. So when we feel disconnected from people, it's been shown that our motivation goes down, our well-being goes down. And we also know that there's a social facilitation effect. We know, like, for example, if you ever ran in a marathon or cycle, when you're surrounded by other cyclists or runners, you tend to do better. So it seems that it's motivational naturally for humans when we have other people around or when we feel connected to others.
Now, is this question dependent on the person? If, for example, you're an introvert, might you not, in fact, embrace the idea of a human-free workplace?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, but it's very difficult unless we start to, again, like every employee gets a personality test, right? But even then, even when you think about introverts, it's not that they don't like people, it's that sometimes too much social interaction is tiring. But they do like maybe limited amounts of interaction, particularly with people they enjoy or they're close to. So I think it may be person-dependent, yes, a little bit, but also maybe work-dependent, you know, depending on your job scope. Unfortunately, I think a lot of when we think human-free workplace, if it's a 100% human-free or is it 0%, you know, or is it 50-50? And if it's 0% human-free workplace, that's probably not that great in the long run.
That was Dr. Chua Suk Ning, a clinical psychologist, weighing in on the question of new workplace arrangements, one that might see the disappearance of direct contact with colleagues. Brian, where do you stand on this? Would you like to see less people in the office?
No, I think it depends on the industry that you're in. So in our case, for example, obviously we have to be physically present here in order to interact.
But do we? Can you imagine a virtual studio where you actually operate from home? And because you could have all the interfaces that will allow you to see the other person visually, you'd be able to make the eye contact that's obviously necessary for us to conduct a conversation.
So some sort of virtual reality type booth.
Absolutely, perhaps. Yeah. But you're still True. Doing it from work. But once, you know, it's 10 o'clock is over and we get into the meetings, we could still do that virtually. And in fact, they have all kinds of, programs. They have something called Slack. And in the US, in 2015, some 500 people used Slack, which is a real-time chat room program, on a daily basis. Last September, that number soared to 6 million. So that suggests, you know, shifting work arrangements, many of which might not disconnect you from your colleagues, but put you in a relationship that's virtual.
So, okay, tools like Yammer and Slack, for example, they help collaboration. So especially if you're in a digital type business, you're in IT, you're in banking and so forth, where you perhaps are able to work, and especially when you have, it's multi-country, geographical areas, operations, that really helps collaboration. So it facilitates the business aspects of interaction in business. However, when you talk about, and you look at the examples of IBM, you look at examples of Yahoo, they've actually brought employees back to the office because too much virtual working, essentially you lose the essence of things. A lot of times, for example, I knew this multinational manager years ago, he actually really worked only 2 to 3 hours a day. He was a very senior person, but he only worked during his con calls, and he got by and coasted through for years. And he said it was the best job he ever had.
So that's an argument for the virtual of arrangement, right? I mean, that's an argument. You just brought up an example where people can limit their interactions, be very effective during those hours where they are interacting, and then they basically can do whatever they want. Instead of being tied down to lunches and, you know, chats on the side and having people come and bother you with their personal problems, all of which might be great and, you know, from the social aspect, but it might be actually quite detrimental to your work-life balance. I mean, you don't want to be necessarily dragged into the lives of others.
But you must have some sort of human contact.
Do you? Must you?
Yeah, because if studies have shown that emotional intelligence is actually declining simply because people are doing more digital interactions rather than physical face-to-face interactions.
Well, you know, I don't know about that. I think maybe our generation doesn't understand what the future is. Maybe we're just not primed for it, you know. Who knows? Anyway, if you have an opinion on this, you can always WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back with a look at a Dayak party and its notions of the pig. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Sweet with Fox on the Run. I'm sure I couldn't with me, Brian Fernandez. It's coming up to 15 minutes past 6 in the morning, and it is the 8th of February 2018. Now, remember, you can be part of this conversation at any point in time by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Put your name there so we know who you are, and or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. That's at BFM Radio. Okay, now we have a story from Sarawak, don't we, Brian?
Yeah, so one of the things we've discussed previously on the Morning Run, Sharad, is how much more tolerant and open people in East Malaysia are, particularly in Sabah and Sarawak. And here we have a story on Parti Bangsa Dayak Sarawak Baru, or PBDS Baru, which has chosen a pig as its mascot for the 14th general election. Now, the party's information chief, Bobby Williams, said it was a symbol of Dayak unity, and he was responding to criticisms that the use of the pig as a mascot offended the sensitivities of certain races.
Oh, certain people, right? It's yeah. Communities. Well, you know, but apparently in Sarawak, this hardly raised a flap among a Malay Muslim politician and voters. So this so-called certain communities obviously is a reference to Malay Muslims for whom pigs are seen as not kosher, right? The other, of course, could be the Jewish community, but because we don't have many Jews left in Malaysia at this point in time. Now, Sarawak's Tourism, Arts, Culture, Youth and Sports Minister, Abdul Karim Rahman Hamza, responded to the story by saying, "It does not have an effect on me, and it's up to the party if they want to have a pig, a cockerel, a dragon or a snake as their mascot." In fact, others found it rather amusing, with some suggesting that it may even bring them good luck, while others suggested they use a crocodile instead as a mascot.
Yeah, so if you look at this, this is an example compared to the controversy that we're having just for having, for example, in the supermarkets and shopping centres, because of Chinese New Year, they're replacing the pigs with, you know, some other symbol and so forth.
Well, not pigs, dogs, right?
Dogs, sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
So you know, it's nice that they're able to look at things very objectively and accept each other's practices in a very open-minded manner.
Yeah. You know, but you look at many countries around the world, majority communities, right, tend to impose their values and their sensitivities, as it were, on others. If you look at what's happening in, you know, Hindu-majority India today, you see that also, especially as the secular values of India have been under attack by, you know, the likes of Narendra Modi, the current Prime Minister, and his party, the BJP, and its ancillary organizations like the RSS. But so majoritarianism, as it's called, is live and well across the world. And Malaysia is not unique in this. The thing about Sabah and Sarawak is that the ethnic and religious community configuration is quite different, right? Yeah, and so where do Malay Muslims figure in this configuration makes it a very different dynamic. I think that's you don't have to reach to, you know, esoteric answers for an understanding of why there's much more tolerance, as it were, at least from the peninsula point of view, there in Sabah and Sarawak.
I suppose that's a very good point, because sometimes we forget just the sheer amount of diversity within Sabah and Sarawak, within the various tribes and ethnic groups and so forth. So I suppose by design or by default, they are automatically more tolerant because there's so many different ethnicities.
Yeah, but you could say that also could be recognized as something of a reality in this part of the federation, right? In the peninsula, we can also recognize that diversity, though demographically we do have a community. But then, you know, one thing I must say, I don't think the Malay Muslim community is necessarily homogenous in its response to these things. These kinds of attitudes, the kinds of statements that we've seen coming out, actually might be coming out from politicians, not necessarily from the ground up. It might be expected by some pressure groups rather than the vast majority of people who are actually identified as Malay Muslim.
And if we look at the politicians in Sabah and Sarawak, they tend to embrace that diversity a lot more, perhaps.
Yeah, in fact, you know, there's been said over and over again that perhaps the idea of Malaysia is most alive in Sabah and Sarawak, much more than the peninsula. The peninsula has been racked by a kind of divisive ethnic and religious identity politics for so many decades in the way that Sabah and Sarawak, which is not to idealize or pretend that Sabah and Sarawak don't have its own challenges when it comes to community relations. I think that's there too, from what I've understood, you know, having traveled to Sabah and Sarawak many times and having friends from there. It is a much more complex situation. We'll be back after the news, as we're coming up to the news, and we have a song that's taking us there. It is Billy Idol, The Cradle of Love. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. And it's time to look at some of the top stories this morning.
Yeah, so yesterday, PKR Vice President and Pandan MP Rafizi Ramli, along with a former public bank clerk, Johari Mohammad, were found guilty for leaking banking details related to the National Feedlot Corporation. Now, this story, Sharad, is on the front cover of the Malay Mail and Utusan. Now, Rafizi was sentenced to 30 months jail by the Sessions Court. Both of them were found guilty of breaching Section 97 of the Banking and Financial Institutions Act, or BAFIA, as it's commonly known.
Yeah, but the two were also granted a stay of sentence, and bail was set at 15,000 ringgit each. Rafizi is now disqualified from running as a candidate in the upcoming general election, GE14. We got in touch with PKR's communications director, Fahmi Fazil, to ask him what Rafizi's next move is.
What I understand is that he will be focusing a lot more on the campaigning, because the entire process of appeals may take a little while until and unless his status has been overturned. Yeah, his conviction has been overturned. He will not be able to contest in the elections, but that does not stop him from helping the campaign. For the party, we are worried because Rafizi, of course, is just one of several key leaders, including Tian Chua and Shamsul Iskandar. Tian Chua being the MP for Batu, as well as the party's vice president, and Shamsul Iskandar being the MP for Bukit Katil, as well as being our party vice president, both of whom have court cases that may disqualify them from becoming candidates in the GE14. But with regards to campaigning, all of the leaders will be focusing on the coming elections. In fact, as you can see, Rafizi has committed to going on the road to make sure that the message of change, message of hope, reverberates throughout the country.
That was PKR's communications director, Fahmi Fazil, on the state of the party moving forward, given Rafizi's verdict yesterday. Now, convicted together with Rafizi is a former public bank clerk, Johari Mohammad. He has been sentenced 30 months, and representing in court was lawyer Latifa Koya. We got in touch with her to ask her how the team reacted and if the verdict was expected.
A verdict, as in whether he will be found guilty, I think... Looking at the way we went through the whole process, you know, he was asked to put in defense anyway. So, yeah, I'm surprised that they also found my client, the bank officer, equally guilty, because there wasn't any evidence of them colluding no evidence as far as the bank officers bringing out the document, printing out the document. Those evidence were not there. So how the court came to that conclusion is quite surprising in that sense. But the second issue is whether the punishment came as a shock. It certainly came as a shock for us because this is, as you know, it's 30 months. And 30 months means roughly about 2.5 years. The maximum punishment for this type of offense is 3 years or fine up to 3 million. There is no minimum there. So the maximum is 3 years. Now, for these two persons to be sentenced close to the maximum is quite shocking and excessive.
Latifa also shared with us her thoughts on the severity of the punishment and the message it carries.
The prosecution came with two cases that involved similar section 97. One person was a bank officer who pleaded guilty to revealing bank details of the Dato' Wee Kasiong. And she was fined 20,000 and 2 days jail. And then there was another person, five charges under section 97, who was sentenced to 20,000 and 2 months jail. That is the kind of average that we got. So to charge and sentence these persons for 30 months is absolutely unacceptable. And the other issue is this, which we have brought to court just now, is the fact that what was revealed was an exposure of wrongdoing or misusing public funds. And after the press conference in which it said to have revealed these details of a bank, that was on the 7th of March in 2012. On the 12th March of 2012, Dato' Saleh of the NFC Corp was charged for CBT. In other words, the AG's chambers had actually used these details or information to bring about two counts of charges under Section 409 of the Penal Code. So in other words, we are saying that the kind of exposure was done in a whistleblowing fashion. So how could you go for these whistleblowers and punish them? If it was any other country, they would have been exempted from being charged because the offence, we agree that there should be secrecy and stuff like that, but Section 97 of the Banking Finance Act should not ever be used to protect wrongdoing or misuse of public funds. That cannot be the objective of that act.
So we asked Latifa what the plans are moving forward.
And so we've been given the instruction to proceed with the appeal. And I believe we have filed the appeal this afternoon. So we're going to fight it all the way up to, you know, to get this whole thing reversed.
That was a lawyer, Latifa Koya, representing former public bank clerk Johari Mohammed in his bank details leaking related case to the Feedlot Corporation's accounts. Now, because other stories in the papers, Brian, this morning, what do we have from the Malay Mail in Utusan?
Yeah, so the Malay Mail has the title, headline, Rafizi gets 30 months. Utusan also has Deda Penyata account, Rafizi Berkas Kerani Bank di jail 30 bulan. So the prosecution apparently had asked for heavier sentence. They asked, in fact, the court to impose a fine of 500,000 ringgit and a prison sentence due to the severity of the case. So according to the deputy public prosecutor, Laila Wati Ali, she said that if we don't impose a heavy penalty, I'm afraid that the public will get the wrong message and that the offence of disclosing public personal information is not that serious.
Well, you know, so this is interesting in terms of what Latifa just spoke about. It was a leak of personal information, but for a larger public good, right?
In this case, they are basically whistleblowers. Right. There has been a prosecution in terms of CBT, yet they've been victimized.
So, you know, this is an interesting question for us in terms of the government's will, right, to combat corruption. Now, maybe our somewhat ambivalent attitude towards whistleblowers here is exemplified in this case. Now, Rafizi also responded, needless to say. He said that he's relieved the judge did not impose any fine and that he was granted a stay of the execution of the sentence. And he's also happy that he's still able to campaign for GE14.
Yeah, so, but however, what's his status as an MP? According to the Election Commission Chairman Tan Sri Muhammad Hashim Abdullah, he said that Rafizi's status as MP would be determined after the conclusion of the appeal process. So, at this point of time, he remains MP for Pandan.
Now, we have some reactions from Barisan National representatives. MP for Pulai, Dato' Noor Jazlan Mohamed, said the decision is a reminder that there is no immunity from prosecution for criminal acts. BN Strategic Communications Deputy Director Eric C2 also urged the public not to fall for Rafizi's, and I'm saying, quotes, sob story. He said Rafizi had used this case for his own personal fame and gain. Now we'll be back with more stories and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.